So as Alice will say, they have absolutely, it doesn't even enter their mind the harm they cause or what it feels like to be on the receiving end. The only thing in their mind is, did I please him? Was I good? Are you happy with me? Do you love me? Will you give me some attention now? Will you praise me? As long as we aren't aware that child rearing is actually a secret weapon, along with this microwave energy weapons, they have multiple secret weapons that, and I say secret because they are not discussed by us. We who are trying to achieve our freedom. And if we aren't discussing what they're using against us, we're stuck going round and round, continuously trying the same things that never worked in the past because we aren't addressing the actual conditions facing us, the actual situation. That's changing now, right? We are spreading these discussions, right? The word is getting out, right? Turning to Alice. She is talking about, she's going to address the sacred values of child rearing, sacred in quotes. And she begins with that quote from Adolf Hitler that we also gave last week. It also gives us a very special secret pleasure to see how unaware the people around us are of what is really happening to them. Unquote from Adolf Hitler. And we're going to get a little bit more understanding of that as she brings back some of these SS officials, officers who we are going to hear from and that help explain, as I was just saying, why they don't care the harm that they cause to others, that the only thing they care about is their tribe. And so when Adolf Hitler talks about this, their secret pleasure, it's a tribal pleasure. It's a communal, I guess we must admit, pleasure. They are better than we. It's the reinforcement that we learned about from Karl Popper, directly from Plato, that the master race must feel that they are superior, that they are united together. So the only thing they care about is each other and getting the approval of each other. What we are learning from Peter and from Alice. Oh, and by the way, please check out, I added some additional from Peter Kropotkin PDF, in which I asked the question, which we're going to be turning to next week. What would be a healthy tribalism? Because when I first started reading The Open Society, Karl Popper's The Open Society and Its Enemies, I had a difficult time with his, which I totally understand now. He was writing during the stomping of fascism across Europe, and he understood, as I did not, and as most people who venture into the open society probably do not understand, that it is a tribal ideology, fascism, and Plato, and any totalitarian ideology, and that what he is opposing to that is a global allegiance to humanity itself. He's very much concerned that when we have a tribal allegiance, it can turn into a totalitarian us against them, I'm better than you notion. And a need to, in fact, suppress others or turn them into us and into yourself to make yourself safer, your tribe safe. Safety for the tribe is all. And so what we're going to be considering, because I'm believing that the trajectory, or the progression of our analysis is towards coming together to discuss and form associations, and here in the U.S., to press forward our right to pursue happiness, and that to form associations to begin to do this is, I think, a useful strategy for us to consider. So my question is, as I forgot to say, what is a healthy tribalism? What is a healthy way for us to form associations? And that's what we're going to be thinking about. What we are learning from Peter and from Alice is that the process of developing empathy is the process of freeing ourselves from the state. And that may be the key right there to my question of how do we create, how do we form ourselves into healthy associations, healthy tribes? It's because we have empathy, we have love. Let's think about that. The process of developing empathy is the process of freeing ourselves from the state, because it wants no love, it wants only allegiance to it. And that is the solution to Socrates' dilemma, and Peter's, and Alice's, and ours. That being, how can, and this is Peter Kropotkin speaking, how can the bulk of the nation, the world, understand before the movement what is necessary to be done as soon as the government is overturned? And I think we're going to be discovering as we think these steps through that, just as Peter said, the work will have already been done. That the process of our developing empathy and forming associations is the process of creating that evolution. That the evolution of our love means the state has already been overturned in us. What follows is mere housekeeping tasks. The modeling for our fellows still enthralled, the empathic parent who releases them from the bondage of their identification with power, with authority, grants them the permission, those few still caught in unconscious patterns, to develop their thought. Our consciousness is enough to withstand the political assault, the backlash, the reaction of power and its agents, the traditional one being co-optation or seduction. Our consciousness means we understand the power dynamics of class and how they are reproduced through totalitarian child-rearing methods. Means we understand the identification with authority in wanting to please the parent. Means we have moved on from it to freedom, bringing with us our brothers and sisters. Quote from Alice. People who have grown up within the value system of poisonous pedagogy and have remained untouched by psychoanalytic insights will probably respond to my anti-pedagogic position with either conscious anxiety or intellectual rejection. They will reproach me for being indifferent to sacred, quote-unquote, values, or will say that I am displaying a naive optimism and have no idea just how bad children can be. In order to teach the child these almost universal underclass values, which are rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition, among others, adults believe they must sometimes resort to lying, deception, cruelty, mistreatment, and to subjecting the child to humiliation. In the case of the adults, however, it's not a matter of negative values, because they have already had their upbringing behind them and use these means solely to achieve a sacred end, to save the child from telling lies in the future, from being deceitful, malicious, cruel, and egotistic. It's clear from the foregoing that a relativity of traditional moral values is an intrinsic part of this system. In the last analysis, our status and degree of power determine whether our actions are judged to be good or bad. And my son told me an interesting story. This is an interjection, my comment, of a kindergartner who pushed another child out of his way. And when my son talked with him about what happened, the child asked, "What would you do if I was a giant?" Continuing with Alice, this same principle prevails throughout the whole world. The strong person dictates the verdict, and the victor in a war will sooner or later be applauded, regardless of the crimes that have been committed on the road to victory. For my part, I can only say that there certainly are values I do not have to relativize, and our chances of survival probably depend in the long run on the practice of these values, among which are respect for those weaker than ourselves, including, of course, the child, and respect for life and its laws, without which all creativity would be stifled. Every brand of fascism lacks this respect, causing psychic death and castrating the soul with the aid of its ideology. Among all leading figures of the Third Reich, I have not been able to find a single one who did not have a strict and rigid upbringing. Shouldn't that give us a great deal of food for thought?